It's the BBG, not the BBC.
You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
And another great day. It's been lovely. It'll be nicer tomorrow and nicer again on Thursday. It's Tuesday, May 5th, 2020. Welcome to the Richie Allen Radio Show. Tony Gosling will join me to talk about what a fascinating period in history in the 20th century. You don't want to miss that. It'll give us a bit of a break from the COVID stuff. Tony Gosling joins me. And as usual, you can tweet the programme. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Let me know what you're thinking about anything today. I don't mind. We'll talk about anything. Anything at all. Anything at all, I tell you. Yeah.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Wasn't it lovely having Mark Boyerski on the radio programme last night, wasn't it? What a breath of fresh air that man is. Great stuff. Mark's website is markboyerski.com. I was asked to talk about that again today. All right? Right? Markboyerski.com. Check him out if you haven't before. As honest and as pure and as sincere a guy as you could ever meet. Mark Boyerski. Well, lovely. Tomorrow and Thursday. I can't... Haven't given you the heads up that the weather is going to be glorious tomorrow and Thursday. If I were you, I would be very suspicious if I was to tweet something tomorrow saying that I wasn't feeling well or that something had happened. I'll be here all right tomorrow and Thursday. Then it gets cool again. You like your weather forecast, don't you? I think you do. Good afternoon. Right, Tony Gosling will join me to talk about Martin Bormann. The private secretary of Adolf Hitler and one of the architects of the Final Solution, a genocidal maniac who allegedly died in May 1945, took his own life, allegedly, and back in the mid-90s, DNA testing said, yes, Bormann died, but Tony Gosling doesn't believe he did, and it's a fascinating story, and that's what we're going to talk about with Tony when he joins us around about 20 minutes to the top of the hour, but no later. I know he's listening. And then we can have as long as we need. It's just Tony today. Ah, yeah. Hey, did you hear this today? Did you hear this today? 3 o'clock, Sky News. 3 p.m, the news bulletin, top of the air. The presenter is a woman called Jane Secker. Lovely.
This is Sky News Today. It's 3 o'clock, the headlines. The UK and US say countries understood to include China, Russia and Iran have launched cyber attacks on British and American labs researching a COVID vaccine.
The US and the UK says what again, Jane? That China, Iran and Russia are cyber attacking labs that are trying to get a vaccine together?
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yes, that's the big story this afternoon, that the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians, and listen, if you've been on a desert island for the last 20 years, they're a shower of bastards, right? Apparently, according to US and UK intelligence agencies, those three dark actors, bastards, are trying to hack scientists and academics who are trying to do a noble thing and get a vaccine for us. Right? Now, you won't know this, but I do because I know everything. There are several government departments that are so secret, most MPs have never heard of them. Honestly, I mean, you'll know the usual departments. Defence, health, agriculture, finance, the environment... The environment, the foreign department, you'll know all that. But one of the most secret departments in government is the Ministry for Making Shit Up. And that's headed up by the Minister for Making Shit Up. It's the best job in the cabinet. It's a total secret. Nobody's even aware of it. Honestly, this is how I believe it really goes. So Dominic Cummings is Boris Johnson's best pal. He's his closest advisor. So he phones up the Ministry for Making Shit Up. Hello, Ministry for Making Shit Up. Paul speaking. How are you, Paul? It's Dominic Cummings here. What have you got for us? How are you, Dominic? Tell the PM to tell the Cabinet to start saying that China, Iran and Russia are hacking our academics and scientists. Brilliant, Paul. Bye. Bye, Dominic. What's up, Paul? You're not your usual chipper self. Is all not well at the Ministry for Making Shit Up? To be honest, I'm a bit fed up, Dominic. There's no challenge in the job. We used to have to work a bit harder at making shit up. But since the Iraq War, Dom, no matter what we say, the media broadcasts it verbatim. Well, that's a good thing, Paul. Ta-ra for now. Fucking hell. How did they keep a straight face, these presenters? It's 3 o'clock. The UK and the US says that Iran, China and Russia are hacking the scientists looking to make a vaccine. Here's Sky News Foreign Affairs editor Deborah Haynes. Well, she must know what's going on. Sky News, Deborah Haynes. What's happening, Deborah?
Well, it's alleged that there's been a malicious cyber campaign. They've been using password spraying, so hitting a target with a number of commonly used passwords, hoping that one of them might give them access to whatever research the target is working on. And so what we've got today is the National Cyber Security Centre, which is a branch of GCHQ, and its US counterpart, issuing this joint advisory to...
Joint advisory?
..to all people working in the healthcare sector and also in research organisations, also local government, urging them to make sure they've got secure, complex passwords, ones maybe using 3 random words and then also 2-factor authentication to try to stop these kind of attacks. But I understand...
Hang on a second now, Deborah. On the one hand, the Iranians, the Chinese and the Russians are dastardly cyber-hacking bastards. But on the other hand, they're not that good, because if you change your password to 3 random words, well, that will, well, it will head off the Ruskies, the Iranians and the chinks. No shame. Yes, I did say chinks, because I'm a racist. Imagine that. It's an advisory note from GCHQ and the Yanks. The Russians, the Chinese and the Iranians are trying to hack the scientists who are doing their best to get a vaccine out for all of us so that we won't die of coronavirus. And the way to beat them is just change your password.
Understand that there has been a significant rise in the number of these kind of state-sponsored cyber attacks against universities, laboratories, pharmaceutical organisations, all types of industry involved in looking for vaccines, testing, anything to do with the coronavirus response. Why is that?
It's why indeed?
It's because intelligence priorities for nation states have fundamentally changed in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, where suddenly research at laboratories is a top priority for governments, and they're clearly willing to use any means to try to access these laboratories and this information. Now, the advisory that's been issued today, it does not name any country specifically, but I understand that those involved in this do include, as you said, China, Iran and Russia.
Ah, Deborah.
What kind of fuckery are you?
Have you got any ovaries, Deborah? Have you got any ovaries? Any at all, like, to challenge any of that? Joint advisory, eh? Random passwords. Any proof, like, when they tell you this horse manure that the Ruskies and their allies of evil, the Axis of Evil, is trying to hack everybody working in healthcare, do you ask them to give you any proof before you go to air with it? Or do you just go to air with it? Lies. Lies, I tell you. Now, Patrick Vallance is a very, very sinister man. As bent as a 7-bob note, a very creepy guy. He's the government's chief scientific advisor. He's running the COVID response for the UK government, is Patrick Vallance. And you will know this by now, because of some very good researchers, that from 2012 to 2018, Patrick Vallance was a big cheese, altogether now, a huge cheese, at a GlaxoSmithKline used to be GlaxoSmithKline Beecham, GSK. He was head of research and development. Big pharma man. Now he's advising the UK government on how to deal with some sneezing and some coughing. Yes, yes. Today, in a health committee meeting where Valance was fielding questions from MPs, he said, "We'll be keeping the 2 meter distance between us for the foreseeable future, and we may need to wear masks at some stage. Here comes an avalanche, dear listener. A tidal wave of bullshit. Feast your ears, Patrick Valance. Listen from moment one."
A minute at 2 meters contact is about the same risk as 6 seconds at 1 meter. So that gives you some idea of why the 2 meters becomes important. And
what was that again? What was that again about time spent 2 meters away from somebody and time spent 1 meter away from somebody? Because I don't think I caught that.
A minute at 2 meters contact is about the same risk as 6 seconds at 1 meter. So that gives...
Oh, Jesus, Mary, and Holy Saint Joseph.
What kind of fuckery are we?
My horse. My kingdom. My kingdom. For somebody who will jump in and say, come on, pal, you know. Anyway, let's hear the rest of it. Patrick Valance.
A minute at 2 meters contact is about the same risk as 6 seconds at 1 meter. So that gives you some idea of why the 2 meters becomes important. And the risk at 1 meter is about 10 to 30 times higher than the risk at 2 meters. So the distancing is an important part of this. Where, therefore, masks may have a role is in situations where distancing is not possible. So there may be some cases where that isn't possible, where there may be undue crowding, but ideally there shouldn't be crowding. There may be times when wearing masks can therefore be beneficial to stop the spread.
Yeah. A minute at 2 meters contact is the same as 6 seconds at 1 meter. That's horseshit. He got that from the Chernobyl movie that was on Sky Atlantic, didn't he? Bullshit. It's like Mark Boyerski said yesterday, it's witchcraft, voodoo, dark spells, massive mind control. It really is. And Bill Gates' mate, he is Bill Gates' mate, by the way, Patrick Valance. Everything he's been doing in recent years has received enormous amounts of money from Bill Gates of Hell, as he's become known these days. This stuff is relentless on television, and I'm finding it very funny. And I think by laughing in its face, I think, somehow, I don't know, maybe we take away its power, maybe. I think maybe we do. Not long after Patrick Valance was on Sky, they brought on Lucy Yardley. Now, she's a pal of Patrick Valance. She's on the SAGE committee as well. SAGE stands for Scientific Advisory Group on Emergencies. They're basically telling the government what to do, right, with Valance heading it up about COVID. So Lucy Yardley, who's on this committee, she's a scientist allegedly, spoke to Sky's Jane Secker, another gormless cardboard cutout of a presenter. You will hear the presenter first.
How tricky will it be to get that message across? I mean, the staying home, protect the NHS, save lives message is a pretty clear one. But how do you get the message across in terms of relaxing that lockdown and not just it not just mean that literally everybody goes outside on the first day?
Well, that's exactly it. That's why it has to be done gradually, because we have to learn new habits one at a time. I think most people are starting to get used to the idea of not being too close to people. We're all used to the queuing outside and so on. So that's actually a good sign for the future, that people are able to learn new ways of doing things if you just take it a step at a time.
The new normal, I mean, we're all getting...
The new normal.
We're all getting used to it, aren't we?
Oh, but we're not, Jane. Do your job, love. What's this we're all getting used to it shit? We're not getting used to it. Some of us don't like it, love. Ask some questions, will you? Nurse Ratched! Sky News is like the nurse's station at the psychiatric hospital that R.P. McMurphy was confined to in Charlie Cheswick. It's the nurse's station. I feel like screaming at them. Nurse Ratched! Ask a question! Just ask one question! We're all getting used to the new normal.
But in terms of the real long term, how long term do you think these kind of measures are going to be?
Well,
Well, that's a $100 million question. At the moment...
So if I gave you $100 million, would you give us the answer?
There are so many things that need to be in place before we could get anywhere near back to normal. Obviously, a vaccine is really important.
Yeah.
Things like mass testing so that we can jump on an infection as soon as it starts breaking out again. Those are incredibly important. So there's a lot of pieces of the jigsaw that have to be in place before we can sort of get on top of this. And it will take months and months, certainly.
Months and months.
So it's months, and it's until we have a vaccine, do you think, pretty much before life can go back to any kind of normality?
Almost certainly, yes. I think that's the case.
There's no almost about it, love. Tell the truth. There will be no return to anything resembling normality until there's a vaccine. This is disgusting stuff, isn't it? Hey? Now, hold your horses for a minute there now. There's quite a few reasons to despise Richard Branson, right? You'll get no argument for me. Every time Branson goes up in a balloon, I pray that this is it, right? I honestly do. I know Mark Bajerski wouldn't be very proud of me now, but every time Branson gets into one of those stupid fucking things and goes up in the air, I pray that this is it. And somehow he survives these crashes, right? So there's a lot of reasons to despise him, but 3,000 people who worked for him, people like you and me, they know nothing of Branson, and they're screwed royally. And you have to feel sorry for them because they're our friends and neighbours. Because Virgin Atlantic has said about 3,000 jobs are gone, and they're going to end their operation at Gatwick Airport. Right? The airlines are screwed, right? Because of this nonsense lockdown, this insanity. And thousands and thousands of people just in that industry alone are being put out of work. Have been put out of work and are now finding there will be no job to go back to. This is horrifying. It's horrifying for people. It is. I am a working class boy from one of the nicest communities that you could ever wish to grow up in, Ballybeg in Waterford City. And my old fella worked at Waterford Crystal for quite a time. Things were good, then things were very bad. And we lived among families. Some families who had jobs and some families who didn't. And I grew up knowing what poverty was like for people from the outside looking in. And then we experienced it ourselves. And it's rotten. It's destructive. Thousands and thousands. It'll be millions. It'll be hundreds of millions in Europe and beyond, people out of work because of this. Destroyed. Right? And they look to the Labour Party. They look to people like the Labour Party, supposedly the party of the worker, for help. Well, they won't get any help because you've got a new leader now for the Labour Party, a guy called Keir Starmer, who's taken over from Jeremy Gormless Corbyn, of course, Catweasel. So you've got Keir Starmer now, establishment to the bone, a Blairite, in every sense of the word, right? This bastard Starmer, as people are losing their jobs, is demanding today that it becomes more difficult for people to get back to work because he wants a new consensus on a new safety standard that every company will have to obey or face being sanctioned. Starmer was doing the media circuit today. God love the workers of the UK listening to Starmer. They need to get back to work because whatever savings they had are gone now. They're looking at taking equity out of their homes to pay their bills. And Starmer goes on TV and on radio and they think, oh, he's the Labour Party guy. He'll do something for us. Starmer says, companies must protect their employees from the virus and obey a new set of standards. This is sick. It's Starmer on BBC Radio 4's Today programme today.
Let's not lose sight of what we're trying to achieve. The point here is to reassure people that it's safe to go back to work. And that really matters because I think the vast majority of people are really anxious about going back to work. And secondly, if we don't put measures in place and the infection rate goes back up again, that would undo everything that's happened in the last few weeks. So this is not a nice to have. It's not a, you know, an unreasonable request. It's absolutely crucial. And frankly, if we didn't do it and the infection rate went up, you would have me back on this programme like a shot to say, why on earth weren't you flagging this as a sort of precondition of your constructive discussions with the government.
If people are worried about going back to work, would you back them if they refuse to do so, if they decide on an individual or even on a union basis that it's unsafe?
Well, that's precisely the position I don't really want to get into, because I want to make sure that people are reassured going back. In other words, I don't want to fight about the situation where it's inadequate. I want to. This is why I'm calling for a national consensus. I'm saying to the government, I think what you put out last weekend was vague and not strong enough. I think we need a national safety standard. By the way, I think you, the government,
but individuals will be making their own decisions, won't they? I mean, on that basis. And let's look at the scenario in case they decide that it isn't safe. Would you back them?
That's why I want a national consensus, because I think people are more likely to be reassured and have confidence if they see political parties, trade unions and businesses all lining up behind a standard that they all think is right and enforceable.
Yeah, the party of labour and the workers and the party of trade unions wants to make it more difficult for employers to function as their employees return to work. Had a few laughs, though, today on the media round. Had a few laughs, more than a few laughs, actually. The current health secretary is an amoeba called Matt Hancock. This guy is so thick, an unexpected bout of prenatal diarrhoea meant that he lost all of his brains in the womb. He is as thick as a Kerry man after a lobotomy, right? Hancock was on LBC News this morning with Nick Ferrari, delighted with himself that he had won a charity bet with the radio presenter. You see, Ferrari wagered that Hancock's health department wouldn't reach 100,000 tests a day or something like that. They were chortling away and all was going well, and then the subject of the Nightingale Hospitals came up. Lovely.
We hear the Nightingale Hospital in London is going to be stood down, I think is the expression. Was it worth the effort, and is it true it never reached full capacity because it wasn't fully staffed?
I think it is a very, very positive thing that we haven't had to use the full capacity of the Nightingale. And absolutely it had the staff, and we would have put more staff in as and when it had to fill up. That wasn't a problem. It isn't finished yet. The project isn't finished yet.
I thought we were standing it down.
No, we are putting it on standby. So it still will be there in case there's a second spike.
How many staff?
We don't want to have a second spike.
No, indeed, sir. It has fewer than 20 patients, I understand, the London one. How many staff are there?
I don't know the exact number this morning.
I don't know the exact numbers this morning. What about last week, then? Or the week before last? Or yesterday? Or a week last Tuesday? What day is it today? What's the square root of 16? Do you know anything, you womble? Well, does he know anything?
But we had the staff necessary and also...
I mean, how many staff typically would there be for a 4,000-bed hospital? I mean, no, what are you talking about? 5, 6?
No. More. You have more for these people in critical conditions. You have more staff than patients. So
we've had 6,000 staff there looking after 20 people.
No. We haven't.
How many staff have we had?
I'm so sorry, Nick. I don't have the figures in front of me. But what I can, what I'm trying to explain is that we had the staff needed to take up to 500 patients, and then we had the plans ready to expand it further. So the staff weren't an issue. The good thing, or the number of staff, I mean, it was fantastic how many people came forward saying that they wanted to help and support and work there. But it's funny, I've seen some media reports saying...
It's not funny. Shut up and answer the question. How many staff have been there? How many patients have been treated there? Come on!
The London Nightingale Hospital isn't needed anymore. You know, what a scandal. It's absolutely fantastic for the nation that we haven't had to fill up a 4,000-bed hospital with people with coronavirus.
Liar, eh? Gelatinous, putrid, slime-sucking, scum-slurping, miserable liar. And he's allowed away with it by Nick Ferrari. After all of those lies, he said it's marvellous that we haven't had to fill a 4,000-bed hospital. Did Nick Ferrari, LBC, and also Sky News regular, Did Ferrari annihilate Hancock? Well, of course he didn't.
And instead, yeah, it's...
What was that? I think he said, oh, I agree with that.
And instead, that. Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Good, right? It's because the overall objective, the number one objective of this, of me as health secretary in this crisis has been to flatten the curve to control the spread and to make sure there's always been enough NHS capacity, and we've achieved that.
And lastly, Sir Keir Starmer.
Yeah, he goes on to Keir Starmer then. Instead of taking him to the cleaners over the Nightingale Hospital and the monumental lies that have been told about the Nightingale Hospital, I've contacted the Parliamentary Standards Committee in London. I don't believe I'll get a reply from them. I have reported the Labour MP, Dr. Rosanna Allen-Khan. Because you might remember two Sundays ago on Sunday View, I was able to demonstrate that she went on Sky News with Sophie Ridge and told the most disgusting pack of lies about working day-long shifts at the Nightingale Hospital, not as a doctor now, doing emergency medicine, but phoning dead people's families to break the news to them gently. This was a horrendous lie. It's right there for the media to destroy these people and say, well, everything you've told us is a lie. This virus is nothing. There is no virus, really. There might be a bit of a bad flu. It might have been a tough flu season. But the whole thing is horse shit. You've done it for other reasons which are very sinister. The media could take these people apart any time. But they choose not to. Let's hear a little bit of Kay Burley before we get Tony on. Now, I don't like to be repetitive. And I like to think I'm not repetitive. But I want to play... Sky News is doing this thing where it's very, very bizarre. I think it's the most bizarre thing I've ever witnessed, watching television news or listening to radio news. This really bizarre, strange thing of every presenter taking time to read the names of people, random people, who have died of coronavirus. Now, this will be the last time that I do this, because I don't like to be repetitive, but I want to play you Kay Burley this morning, because there's a point I'd like to make at the end of it. It might be a moot point, it might be a silly point, it might be a bit immature, and God knows I can be immature, but I want to do that. Here's Kay leading up to the death notices. This fascinates me because commercial radio stations in Ireland, God's country, where I come from, the land of milk and honey, the land of milk and honey, commercial radio stations earn money by broadcasting death notices. Like WLRFM in Waterford will every... It's a very important service, by the way. I don't in any way mock it or send it up. The receptionists who work at radio stations will get some information in from the undertakers, and maybe the bereaved, maybe they want to get word out to the community about the funeral arrangements of Mrs. Ann Smith or Mr. Pat Murphy, for example. So the radio station broadcasts this and they make some money out of it. And when I was at WLRFM in Waterford, we broadcast death notices twice a day. It might be three times a day, but I remember it being twice a day. So I'm fascinated by this. But there's something going on. It's the last time I'll do this. Here's Kay leading into the death notices. She talked about Love Island, and I think she talks about the car industry here, and then we'll hear the death notices. Easy for you to say, Richie.
Meantime, this is staggering. Demand for new cars has plummeted by around 97% last month as the UK's motor industry has taken a hit from the COVID-19 pandemic. Only 4,000 cars were registered in April, according to preliminary figures from the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. That's a similar number to the amount of cars on the roads in the months after the Second World War. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Into the depths now.
Well, while people across the UK continue to die from COVID-19, the country has recorded the smallest daily increase in the overall death toll in 6 weeks. More than 28,000 people, coronavirus patients, have now died in hospital across the UK and many others in care homes. Every one of them, as we say,
Every single one of those numbers represents someone's loved one or friend. We know the eldest was 108, the youngest was just 6 years old. We had some messages actually yesterday at Sky News from the family of one of the victims of coronavirus that we featured here on the programme, who said that it helped significantly knowing that the wider world was aware of their pain and also how much their loved one would be missed. Like,
she's a liar, Kay. If one of the death notice benefactors had actually contacted Sky to say thanks for doing it, she would have named him. This is quite strange, this.
Would be missed, like 107-year-old Ethel Lees. She's one of Scotland's oldest coronavirus victims.
Let's get rid of the stupid music. Have a listen.
Those who want to remember her have been encouraged to enjoy a wee spot of tea, a biscuit and a puzzle in her honour. Dr. Saad Al-Dubaizi was a GP from Bury. He died on Sunday. One of his colleagues said he will always be remembered for his dedication to work despite the risks. Ray Lever, there he is. He was only 62, domestic services assistant at Sheffield's Northern General Hospital. His family thanked medical staff for Ray's outstanding care, which included fulfilling his last request to have a drink of his favourite beer. God rest his soul.
God rest his soul. Pause for effect.
Goodness me. Every
goodness me.
One of those figures that we hear about, that the ministers tell us about every day at those daily briefings, have a story like this behind them. There you are, Ray Lever. He was just 62 when he died. He was a healthcare worker in Sheffield. Our thoughts go to all his family and friends and all of those who have lost loved ones as a result of this wretched disease. Government doing what it can, it tells us, to try to get on top of this disease, like an app that's being launched on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, the app on the Isle of Wight, the contact and trace app and all of that. I'll tell you what I think, we won't be doing that anymore, but that is, for me, and for anybody else who's worked in broadcast news, and I know some of my listeners have worked in broadcast news, have worked in production, have worked on either side of the microphone, you'll know what's going on there. I'll tell you what I think is going on there very simply, and I'll put it very simply. When we had the floods earlier in the year that devastated communities and cost lives as well, a real emergency, why didn't we see that carry on, the carry on of Burley and the other presenters reading out the names of the dead? Because the floods, even if they were not caused by climate change, which they weren't, because climate change isn't real, it's nonsense. The floods were real. The floods were real. This pandemic isn't real. It isn't. And this vaudevillian crap that we're witnessing every day on television and radio news, this bizarre nonsense has been put in place to convince as many people as possible that the pandemic is real. It's the only logical conclusion you can draw from a national television station asking every one of its primetime presenters to stand alongside a video wall and read the names of random people who died after allegedly being diagnosed with coronavirus. It makes no sense. It's unprecedented. And for me, it says they are desperate for people to believe this horse manure. That's exactly what it is. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is live from Salford in Greater Manchester. And my name is Richie Allen, the BBG, not the BBC. Tony Gosling, formerly of the BBC, will be with me in a few minutes' time, live from Bristol. Don't go anywhere.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos,
reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbyursky.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Now you are very welcome back to Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. The old voice is struggling today. You get days like that, you know. You get days like that. And I think I'll need a cold beer after the programme. The studio is only roasting. Shall we give Tony Gosling a bell? Let's give him a bell. Top man is Tony Gosling. You know him, of course, from the Politics Show in Bristol. Terrific show, thisweek.org.uk. A few weeks ago, Tony said to me, he said, Richie, what do you know about Martin Bormann? Of course, I had to tell the truth. Not a lot. You're a history graduate, I know. I know that he was a bastard. I know he was a dreadful, dreadful human being. Private secretary to Adolf Hitler. Wielded extraordinary influence in the party and over Adolf Hitler. Party to genocide. Key decision maker. And officialdom, or official sources will tell you, that he fled Berlin in May of 1945. After Hitler killed himself, Bormann apparently fled Berlin, tried to flee Berlin anyway to avoid capture, you see, by the Russians. That's how it goes. We are told that he probably committed suicide on a bridge. And that was the end of him. And back in 1998, I believe, DNA testing claimed that it was indeed Bormann, and Bormann was dead and had died on a bridge back in 1945. End of story. But some people think that was the beginning of the story. Maybe he didn't commit suicide on a bridge in 1945. Tony Gosling's a terrific journalist, great broadcaster and writer, formerly of the BBC. His politics show on Bristol's BCFM, which you can find out all about at thisweek.org.uk, is a must-listen radio show every Friday. Delighted to welcome him back to the country and the programme. It's our pal Tony Gosling. How you doing, Tony?
Oh, not too bad, Richie. Thanks very much for your intro. I mean, one of the things I do is, I mean, when I was working at the BBC, I first joined them in 1989, and there was still this real go-getting attitude, like we are totally independent, at least amongst some people, and we are going to be calling anyone that causes any trouble in this world of ours to account. And that attitude, that state of mind, that spirit was still alive in the BBC. I'm not saying it's completely gone, because, for example, tonight there's a documentary on BBC Scotland about Ewan Cameron, the guy who was the scientist behind MK Ultra. So that, I believe, is an hour and a half documentary. So there's still a bit of it about. But most of the people like me who were digging in places where, for example, I was working in Salisbury when I finally got sacked, digging into Ted Heath and possible links to because he lived in Salisbury, and child abuse going on in children's homes there. It was never provable that was why my contract was never renewed. But the problem is here, you can't, you know, that seemed to me now, looking back on it, it was quite obvious. You know, I was trying to get some approval from the editors and the managers to go with this story that we've got, and found it's only a little tin pot local radio station. But then I found myself out of my ear, Richie.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt it was your looking into former Prime Minister Edward Heath and what he was doing there. There's no doubt about it. Here's the $64 million question. I know you'll be honest. Knowing what you know now, to preserve your job and maybe do some good, would you have backed away from the Heath stuff to keep your job?
Well, I wasn't really given an option, but no. The answer, of course, is no.
Good man.
Because how can you sit there and talk about the latest bottle bank being installed in the town when you know that there's a sort of dark heart at the centre of the goings on there? I mean, the other thing about this Bormann story is the thing, and you've actually just prompted this in my mind, you know, because you pointed out quite rightly about the evidence that came to light in big inverted commas in the 1990s about Bormann's body being discovered, blah, blah, is that there were two occasions in the last century when there was big news stories about, oh, they've discovered his body in Berlin, or they've discovered proof that this really was his body. The first was when Stuart Stephen, who's a former Bristol journalist working at the Daily Express, exposed, along with Ladislas Farago, who's a Hungarian journalist, that Bormann was alive in South America, and they had a photograph of him in 1972. It was literally within 2 weeks, the story then came out, oh, we've discovered his body in Berlin. This can't be true. And that was in 1972, at the end of 72. And then at the end of, I think it was 96, when this second revelation about, oh, we've definitely concluded that this is definitely his skull. Well, that was just after the publication of a book called Op JB, which is subtitled The Last Great Secret of the Second World War, by Christopher Crichton, who used that name because he didn't want to use his real name because he was worried, even though he was in his 70s, that he might be done under the Official Secrets Act. So, you know, you can see what happens here. As the truth starts to emerge, so the lies come along like a giant sledgehammer and smash it down. And I'm really, you know, I've seen so many examples of this in this story. It's just like a kind of goldmine story. And there are two main books around it. I just mentioned Op JB, and I never met him before. He died 2 or 3 years ago, John Ainsworth Davis, the author of that. But I met his wife and, you know, had long chats with her about the whole thing. I'm absolutely convinced that it's a true story, just simply because I've seen the way that there's been attempts over the years to cover it up. So that's really the first story of Bormann, is in that book, Op JB. And that came out in the 90s. But a decade before, in a weird way, it's kind of in reverse, right? Because that tells the story of Bormann being brought from Berlin under the noses of the Russians by commandos along canals and rivers into the British sector. And then he kind of disappears for a while. And apparently there's an 800-page dossier, which has probably been burnt now, but I wonder if anyone kept copies of it, which is a debriefing of Bormann, where he tells his entire story of what happened in the Second World War, his rise to power. But then there's an American, sorry, Canadian journalist. No, he's an American, sorry. A guy called Paul Manning that picks up the story, because he then discovers, he was one of the top journalists of World War II, working for CBS on the radio, like I used to be. And then he writes a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which then talks about what Bormann was up to. And Richie, I've never been so surprised by my YouTube interview I did with Talk Radio Europe back in February 2016, which was only, I think it was only about 25 minutes or something, 20 minutes. And I put it up online. It was called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit. And it was really a review of that book, Martin Bormann, Nazi and Exile. It talks about basically a financial Fourth Reich. So the idea here is that the Germans, the Nazis, had developed this technique whereby the banks could basically buy up a whole country's infrastructure and use that to take over the country rather than using armed force. And they did that to a large extent before they attacked the Low Countries and France. Much of the French, this is what he describes, this was a technique that Bormann was using. And the idea was to carry this on after the Second World War, to create a financial empire, a financial Fourth Reich, finance massive things like pharmaceutical companies. And the evidence is, I think, that that's exactly what they've done. Basically, that money that Bormann had control of, around about $1 billion at the end of the war, which was a hell of a lot of money.
In gold, wasn't it, Tony? Was it? A lot of it was in gold bullion, no?
Yeah, a lot of it was, but a lot of it was also securities for firms, what they call bearer bonds, which are basically like banknotes, but they're share certificates that can be passed from hand to hand.
Right.
And these were squirreled away down in Switzerland. And Op JB tells the story of how Ian Fleming flew to Switzerland to try and find out who had control of all these Nazi assets towards the end of the war. But that's, you know, jumping ahead a little bit. I think, you know, the main thing about the Op JB book is describing this guy, John Ainsworth Davis, being basically groomed as a double agent to then be sent in at the end of the war to get Bormann out. I mean, he talks, for example, about in October 1940 going over to Donegal and destroying two U-boats that were being refueled there as a way to sort of get himself known to the Germans. And then after that, he then said, well, actually, I'd do anything for money. And that's when he started his career as a double agent. He was then, in 1942, he was involved in the Dieppe raid, Operation Jubilee. He said, well, if you pay me, I will tell you when the raid on Dieppe is going to be. And so he was actually interrogated by Rommel, who explained to him, look, you know, if you... He had him on the coast. This is what he says in the book. He had him on the coast with a gun to his head and saying, look, if this raid doesn't arrive, we're just going to shoot you now and throw you over the cliff. This is in 19th of August 1942. 10,000 troops arrived to do a raid on Dieppe. It was supposed to be a great success and to prove to Stalin that he wasn't having to fight the war on his own. Well, because it was betrayed by John Ainsworth Davis, it meant that those 10,000 troops, 1,500 of them roughly died, 500 were wounded, almost all Canadians. But of course, this was something that I suppose that the Brits felt they could do to the Canadians. So that was Operation Jubilee, 19th of August 1942. And by that act, really, he proved to himself, or he proved to the Germans, that he was working for them. But of course, he was actually a double agent, and so many people were sacrificed just to prove to the Germans that this guy was good. And then after that, Slapton Sands cover up, he talks about that, where 1,000 died because a pre-D-Day operation on the 28th of April 1944 was raided by some German E-boats, and 1,000 sailors and soldiers died in that. But that was all covered up during the war. And then he goes on to talk about the, you know, much more interesting, I think, the really swan song, which was this Op JB from the 1st to the 11th of May 1945, Operation James Bond, which he talks about at the end of the book. Well, really, it's the key thing in the book, because to bring Bormann out, do it entirely secretly, and then to cover up all the documents afterwards was an incredible thing to do.
Right, let's take this step by step, because I reviewed the documents on politicsthisweek.wordpress.com. Thank you very much. Tony Gosling is our guest. I would imagine that my Irish listeners, I can only imagine, when you said Donegal and a U-boat being blown up, their ears went to the sky, and you said that this was the guy who wanted to prove himself to the Germans, the guy that was going to actually carry out the operation to get Bormann out. So let's go back to the very beginning then and take this step by step. We've got an hour from here, if you want to. Tony Gosling is our guest, top man, journalist, great friend of mine, been speaking on this programme and others for many, many years. And I'm fascinated by this story. I talked about Martin Bormann earlier on. People don't get more odious than this guy, a genocidal maniac. And it's believed that he committed suicide on a bridge in 1945 to avoid capture. But there is real doubt that maybe that didn't happen. Now, Tony said to me, actually, about a week or two ago, Tony said, Richie, when I come on to talk about this, he said, I want you to do what you do and have a go at me. I'm not going to, T. I'm not going to, because it's fascinating. Not going to have a go at you at all. My listeners are not stupid. They'll make their own minds up. I think it's fascinating and it's brilliant. And I'm loving it. And of course, when I said you were coming on today to talk about this, you saw the Twitter thing. It went mental with people going up. I totally believe that Bormann didn't die and he was taken out. Right. Step by step, Tony. This guy is a madman. Why would people in the West, why would people, operatives or politicians in the UK or elsewhere, why would they want to let this guy off the hook? Now, I know you talked about him having control of bullion. I know you said he had securities, Tony. That makes a bit of sense to me. But couldn't they just steal that stuff from him? So why were they prepared to get into bed with this nutcase, this scumbag, and save him, basically, and rescue him from his, well, undoubtedly his fate was to be swinging at the end of a rope after Nuremberg. So why?
Okay, the main reason was what Ian Fleming discovered when he flew over to Switzerland just before the operation, which was that this guy's signature was what they needed. The thing is that the loot was all secreted, almost all of it, in Switzerland. There's no way the Swiss authorities are just going to let anybody come along and take that. I mean, they can kill Bormann, but what's that going to get them? If they don't kill him, they can start doing deals with him. He has a lot of cards up his sleeve, Richie. One of the most important cards is the nuclear program that the Germans had been doing. Now, if you think about all the names of the nuclear scientists, the nuclear weapon that Churchill was so afraid was going to be stuck on the end of a V2 and dropped on London, it's quite plausible, and there's a lot of evidence for the accumulation in Nazi Germany of enriched uranium. They had the technology to do it. They had the heavy water plant up in Norway in order to help with the bomb making. And it's quite clear, actually, this has come out only over the last few years. I mean, it's amazing the way stuff emerges such a long, long time afterwards. It is that there was a sighting actually in Germany of nuclear. This is, I think it was in the Daily Express about a year ago, the first time I ever saw it, of the, various witnesses saying that they saw a mushroom cloud in Germany.
In Germany.
And if this is true, and it's entirely possible that it is, if this is true, this means that actually the very first nuclear test wasn't conducted by the Americans and the Manhattan Project. It was conducted by the Nazis. Now, this doesn't, it might sound, you know, intuitively, oh, no, that can't be possible. Well, think of all of the names of all of the nuclear bomb scientists, the nuclear scientists, the atom was first split by the German scientists. And, you know, even Frisch and Pyles, these are the two guys at Birmingham University that designed in 1940 the first atomic bomb, which Churchill said, well, we haven't really got the capability to build it in Britain. And he sent all those people over to the US as part of something called the Quebec Agreement to build it over there. But they were both, one was Austrian, the other one was German. These are the designers of the bomb in Birmingham in 1940.
So you think the Germans might have been ahead? You think the Germans might have even been ahead or way ahead of their American counterparts in developing the nuclear, what we call the atomic bomb? They might have been.
I don't think there's any doubt about that now. There's lots of evidence has emerged of the fact that there was a program in the US to build an atomic weapon. Why was Churchill so? I mean, if you go through, there's various books about the sort of technical side and the scientific side of the war, and you will see Churchill. You know, he really was worried that there was going to, because the V2 was arriving on London, and at any minute one of those could have an atom bomb on it. I mean, of course, the top people in Britain and in the United States were aware that this was possible. But anyway, so that was an enormous bargaining chip. And one of the things that I've discovered through interviewing Carter Heydrich, who's the author of a book called Critical Mass: How Nazi Germany Surrendered Enriched Uranium for the U.S. Atomic Bomb, was that they had actually quite a lot in fact, what he says in the book is the evidence that he's dug out from the US archives is 560 kilos of enriched uranium went onto this submarine called U-235, and it was heading to Japan very slowly, chugging just under the sea at the end of the war. And of course, Hitler handed on power to Dönitz. So Dönitz, once Bormann had done his deal in London, and the dates are incredible here. So Bormann was delivered, according to the OpJB book, Bormann was delivered to Desmond Morton, who was Winston Churchill's private secretary in the British sector in Germany, on the 11th of May, 1945. Well, it was the night of the 12th and the 13th of May that this submarine carrying this enriched uranium, U-235 was the name of the submarine, would you believe? Oh, no, sorry. No, U-234 was the name. It's easy to get confused. U-234 was the number of the submarine, and the enriched uranium was U-235, 560 kilos of it encased in gold in drums. That submarine suddenly stopped. The two Japanese officers on it, Hideo Tomonaga and Lieutenant Genzo Soji, were then either shot or committed suicide. And then the submarine changed course and started heading to Portsmouth Naval Base in the US. So there is one little potential deal that Bormann did when he got to Britain, is to make sure that the Japanese didn't get that enriched uranium for an atomic bomb, and the Americans did instead. So you can see the high stakes that were going on.
This is fascinating, Tony. And look, it's plausible. It doesn't mean it's true, but it's plausible, and it's very interesting. Well, it's beyond very interesting. So let's talk about Bormann again in terms of these wouldn't have been conversations Bormann would have had in 1945. Who knows how long Bormann was having conversations with representatives of the British government or British intelligence or US intelligence. It could have been going back two, three, 4 years, Tony.
Well, look, and also, I mean, I've spoken to people who I've got contacts who are connected with the Nazi community in Argentina after World War II. And many of them are just ordinary people like you and me. You know, they've just been sort of told stuff by grandparents and things. One of the other things that was handed over to the Americans in that submarine, and this is also in Carter Heydrich's book, is the fuses that were necessary to explode a plutonium bomb. So, you know, there was the uranium bomb first at Hiroshima, and the other bomb at Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb. So they wanted to try both of them out. In fact, of course, we now know that they didn't really need to use either of them. And there's a whole load of literature around, you know, what happened to Roosevelt? Why did he die? And why did Truman then pop up and suddenly say, yes, let's try this bomb out? Anyway, so the fuses for plutonium were particularly awkward because plutonium has to be compressed into a critical mass very, very quickly. You can't just stick it in a what they use this kind of bullet thing in the uranium bomb where you just fire these two into each other. No, the whole thing has to be imploded in a sphere very, very fast. And they couldn't find a way to get the electricity to all the explosives to make this thing implode fast enough. But the Germans had developed an infrared system of fuses to wrap around the sphere of plutonium. And they were also on this submarine, apparently. So, you know, there's a whole load of technology. I mean, of course, there may be other stuff we still don't know about.
And Bormann, Bormann had access to this. This is why I asked that question about, did Bormann switch sides in the early 1940s? Did Bormann see the writing was on the wall for the Fourth Reich? And did he switch sides? Because
I don't think he had any sides. He's just one of these like mafia style characters that's working for whoever is going to give him the most. I mean, you know, I don't think he had any particular principles.
No, of course
although
not.
He particularly hated Jews because he was a very, very key person.
Christians too. He hated Christians too, it must be said.
Was he created this thing called the Wannsee Conference. In fact, he organized the whole thing, which took place just near Berlin. And that was towards the end of the war. It was on the 20th of January, 1942, actually halfway through. But what they decided to do at that conference was basically to agree a plan to exterminate as many Jews and other undesirables as possible, but to keep it secret and to agree code words that they were going to use and to also agree to keep all of the discussion about it out of any kind of bits of paper and communications. So it was a very important conference when it comes to the Holocaust.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Bormann organised the whole thing. He basically sent out the invites, but he very cleverly did not attend himself.
Didn't go.
So he seems to me, even in 42, he was thinking, well, if I survive the war, I don't want them to be able to pin this on me.
Now, here's a question. We're talking about Martin Bormann, dear listener. If you've just joined us, Tony Gosling, The Politics Show. When you said a minute, I used to work on, you still work on Radio T. The BCFM is a great station. And,
no, at the moment, no. Because of the coronavirus, we have a what they call emergency schedule, and we're online only until the emergency schedule is over. And I've not really been told how long that'll be. So we're kind of suspended from FM. So, you know, you could say the last man standing has been knocked down, but I've not quite been knocked down yet. We're definitely doing everything online. In fact, this week we did a whole hour and a half with the candidates for the election that's just been cancelled, all except from Bristol's mayor, Marvin Rees, who decided he didn't want to join us. But we had all the other candidates, four other candidates, the Tory, the Lib Dem, the Green guy, and also a trade union coalition, all these people who were standing to be mayor. And this week, by the way, in 2 days' time, there was going to be an election. And what's happened is the previous mayor has got a free pass. But I thought it was well worth broadcasting that. But our managing editor obviously didn't. So we will see. Hopefully I'll be back on there once this lockdown thing is over.
Yeah, as soon as possible. We've been talking about Martin Bormann, of course, who's a notorious name in 20th century history. Of course, the former private secretary, the former, he was the private secretary to Adolf Hitler. And as Tony has just been describing, he was a genocidal maniac. Tony has been looking into for many years the idea that Bormann didn't commit suicide in May of 1945, but in fact that he was spirited, he was rescued by, well, assets of British intelligence, maybe US intelligence, because of the things he knew, because of access he had to gold bullion and securities, and in terms of billions of pounds, information he had pertaining to research and development by the Nazis. This is fascinating stuff. It's very important to be talking about this, I think, today. Okay. So here's a question. I've got to ask you this. Yep. Really important, because I'm getting abuse here now, and I deserve it. This guy who was charged with overseeing the operation to get Bormann out, this guy who blew up submarines in Donegal. I went to primary school and secondary school in Ireland, and we never heard about any submarines moored or docked or just off the coast of Donegal that were blown up. You said this guy carried out this as a way of proving that he was the man to go and rescue Bormann. Tell us more about that in Donegal. Fascinated by that, T.
All right, well, look, one of the things that John Ainsworth Davis talks about in his book, which is the actual author on the cover of the book, is Christopher Crichton, is that at the end of the war, literally the weeks after the war, both he and Ian Fleming spent several weeks going through all the documents that had been in the British military to do with their sightings of these and their reconnaissance of these U-boats in Donegal, and they went and forged loads of documents to make sure it was all covered up. And that was a large part of, in fact, you'll find that quite a lot in the book. There are various things that they have to go and do where, hang on a minute, we can't allow this to ever come out. Another one of them was the blowing up of a submarine, a Dutch submarine called KXV-11, on the 28th of November 1941, this submarine made the terrible mistake of spotting the Japanese fleet as it was heading for Pearl Harbor, and they radioed it through. You know, we've spotted this fleet going towards Pearl Harbor. Well, what he talks about in there is that he was then sent from in a Royal Navy vessel to meet up a month or so later with this submarine to give them a whole load of Christmas presents, only to be opened on Christmas Day. Well, he gave them these several boxes of presents. They took them into the submarine, and as they closed the hatch, he pressed a button, and these things all blew up, including with a whole load of poison gas capsules in them, because they wanted nobody to survive from that submarine to make a fuss after the war that they had warned everybody about Pearl Harbor happening. Of course, the reason is because they wanted Pearl Harbor to be a surprise attack. At that time, you know, end of 1941, the US public were completely against getting involved in the war. They saw it as something going on in Europe, long way away, and they needed this surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, on the American ships. Of course, they'd managed to get all their most modern, up-to-date ships out of Pearl Harbor. Most of the ones in Pearl Harbor were the older ships that they didn't really mind losing so much. But it created an enormous, powerful, dramatic effect on the US public, and it brought them immediately into World War II. So, you know, this is the sort of thing that they did. They had to cover up all the documents to do, for example, with that whole raid on that submarine. So a lot of the work that they've been doing, he and Fleming spent quite a lot of time, you know, forging documents and things after the war to make sure that their trail was covered.
What a story this is, Tony, if it's true. What a story. And listeners are loving this on Twitter, and they're mentioning people like Joseph Mengele. They're mentioning Operation Paperclip. They're talking about Operation or Project Bluebeam. And there's been a brilliant comment from one of our listeners, David, I think it is. And he says, the irony that post-war, the USA was a major refuge for all of these hateful, horrible, genocidal maniacs. And then the US itself became a pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist state. That's a comment that I'm seeing quite a bit on our Twitter, on my Twitter feed, as it were. So Project Bluebeam Operation Paperclip, relevant, Tony, to be talking about those, while we're talking about the theory that Borman was rescued?
The main take home from all of this is that by 1944, 1945, there were already movements in the West, in Britain and the US. And the big take home, of course, is that whilst many of these Nazis did indeed go to the US and the technology went to the US, that Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, in London, was actually at the heart of the operation to make that happen. So the Brits were the sort of steering hand behind it, although the US were the major beneficiaries. But the main thing here is that NATO, which was formed immediately after the Second World War, actually included many Nazis. And there is a great quote I dug out, must be, 20 years ago, from one of the top SS generals saying that NATO was formed. The original people of NATO were basically the supporters of the Nazis in the NATO countries. They were the people that actually started up NATO. And you can see how many people, I mean, Churchill after the war, for example, had to be kept off the BBC, the new television service and the old radio service, because he kept talking about wanting to nuke Moscow. You know, there was a really absolute hatred of communism, but that was already brewing during the war. So I think that there was many German units hated the idea of surrendering to the Russians. So they brought, right at the end of the war, almost all the commanders brought their people and their soldiers over to the Western Front to surrender there, because they knew if they were to surrender to the Russians, they'd be probably executed. Whereas they were already starting to do deals and making friends with the Allies.
Isn't that amazing? Tony Gosling is our guest. Thisweek.org.uk, you'll find all of this info. Tony has a brilliant timeline. I'll give you the proper. It's politicsthisweek.wordpress.com. And that's where you'll find the Martin Bormann timeline. Let me ask you this. Bit of mischief making here, Tony. You and I first spoke many moons ago about Princess Diana. I think the first time we spoke was about Princess Di. That would have been back in, I reckon, our first conversation was around about 2009. So 12 years you and me have been chin-wagging. The Duke of Edinburgh is a powerful man. And he's a Nazi. He is. Would he have been involved? Would he have had any knowledge about people like Martin Bormann, these awful men, Mengele, all these people that were basically getting let off the hook when they may have been swinging, as I said, after Nuremberg? I wonder, did the Duke of Edinburgh have anything to do with any of this?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's fair to say.
It is. Go ahead. It is, T. Go ahead, say it. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if it is fair to say that. I don't know if he is or not. But it certainly, King George VI was very much aware of all this stuff I'm talking about, because he financed M section of MI6, which is basically his own private branch of MI6. And Desmond Morton, Churchill's private secretary, was his main operational commander. So, for example, John Ainsworth Davis in his book describes being brought in to see Morton one day in Whitehall and ordered in to go and see him because he was being briefed as a double agent for the Brits, spying on the Nazis. And he sat and he could hear somebody behind him. He turned around and there was the king sitting behind him. So, you know, the idea that this man or the royal family were not involved is quite obviously not true.
Fanciful,
the extent to which, for example, the present queen knew, I think it's entirely feasible she wasn't in the loop at all. But, the other thing, of course, is with Prince Philip is he was educated by Nazis, but to actually say he is a Nazi, I mean, okay, so he also said that thing about coming back. He wanted to come back as a deadly virus to reduce the world's population, didn't he? Which is a little bit of a, kind of
his
eugenicist.
Sister, his sisters married Nazis and he went to Nazi funerals. And he knew, or he must have known, what these people were up to. He is about the worst human being. You've only got to look at him. He looks like that priest, that Reverend Cain from Poltergeist 2. He's evil incarnate. And I'm not saying that for a giggle. And I do believe he was absolutely involved in the assassination of Princess Diana. I have no doubt he had some part to play in that.
So that I think, yes, you could probably almost, well, you can almost certainly say that senior people in the royal family were aware that she was going to be bumped off. It's called the Way Ahead Group, which was exposed by John Morgan before he died, that this group was meeting every 6 months and it had a special meeting just before the death of Diana. These are senior royals and their private secretaries who basically, the Way Ahead Group's job was to manage threats to the royal family. And what happened, you know, in the last year or so of her life after the divorce was she became a threat. She became basically a reputational threat to the royal family. And they were completely at sixes and sevens about what to do about it, because she was on many of the newspapers. They'd done everything they could to get her bad press as much as they could. But still, some of the tabloids had pictures of her in a positive way. And then, of course, there was Andrew Morton's book, which came out, Diana, Her True Story, which then showed just what terrible husband Prince Charles had been to her, and how she was entirely the victim. And she actually started getting better. She started to get much more confident after she went to a party at Camilla's sister, I think it was, house with Prince Charles, where Camilla was as well. And she confronted Camilla in the middle of the party and said, "What do you think you're doing with my husband? Get away from him." And, you know, Camilla, but once she'd done that, she'd had the confidence to do that at a private party, but in public in front of people, she got a great deal more confidence. And then they relied, I suppose, on keeping her down, Richie, you know, on actually smashing her spirit. But she rose up against it. And the fact that she started successfully fighting back just by being a beautiful, honest person, she had to go, I guess. That's what the Way Ahead Group decided.
Yeah, she had to go. Noel Botham, again, somebody who you would have been intimately acquainted with, a lovely gentleman, rest in peace. Noel wrote some amazing books about Princess Diana. This is going all over the place. It's really fascinating. I think my and this is why I've loved speaking with you for the last 12 years, and I mean that. One of the things that I think about Princess Diana is I think about Bill Clinton and the verbal promise she'd gotten from old Bill to basically end the manufacture of landmines globally. And I always believed that that played some part in her downfall, because that couldn't be allowed to happen. What do you think, T?
Definitely, yeah. Nicola Soames apparently phoned her up because one of her friends overheard the conversation. Old Tory grandee basically threatening her, saying, "Look, unless you back off from this program, you know, bad things are going to happen to you." And that's in one of the documentaries, although, of course, probably the key documentary of all of them is the one made by Keith Allen.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Isn't it Unlawful Killing, I think it is, which is so-called banned everywhere, you know, because the royal family has taken out, saying that they want to have, I think, is it 50 edits in the film?
That's now, right, 50, yeah.
Free press.
Yeah, 50. They wanted all mention of Philip taken out. I want to read you something very briefly. Jean Anne, the great Jean Anne, a huge help to me, Tony, has sent me a few lines from the late, great Jim Mars book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Rest in peace, Jim Mars. Jim wrote, "When Martin Bormann's wife was captured in a small hotel in northern Italy, she had 2,200 antique gold coins in her possession. Bormann himself sent gold coins to Argentina by submarine, where on arrival his treasure was placed under the personal protection of Evita Peron." And the wife, Bormann's wife, allegedly died of mercury poisoning even, in March of 1946. This is some story, Tony, eh?
Well, I think it's one of the biggest stories, really.
Yes.
Running into the spine of history, really, because the other thing is that connects Morton back to the First World War as well. I mean, we haven't even mentioned Edward VIII, who was king, but he was also very pro-Nazi just before the war. This royal family, you know, I think there needs to be some serious questions about them. They changed their name, didn't they, at the time of the First World War, from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, because the Goethe bombers were coming over and dropping bombs on our soldiers. So we can't have a king with the same name as the bombers that are coming and killing our men. But I mean, you know, there's so many. I mean, what, for example, with Edward VIII, it's some brilliant work's been done on him. And it's quite clear now that over in Lisbon, where he was over in Lisbon, he actually was talking to the ambassador to Portugal from Nazi Germany, desperately trying to persuade him to start bombing London, to actually start the Blitz. This is back in 1940, because they had this thing called the Phony War for the first 6 or 8 months of the war. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, the first bombs fell on London.
Hang on a second. So, now, you're saying that Churchill's secretary, Morton, was in Lisbon urging...
Oh, no. That's Edward VIII.
Excuse me, Edward VIII.
We've got two things going on here.
Yeah, I'm all over that. No, it's my fault. I'm a bit warm in studio. I'm a bit warm in studio.
Me too.
But that's bad enough.
Edward VIII. After he abdicated, was Wallace Simpson was a Nazi agent, and they were actively trying to get and succeeded in getting the Nazi high command to start bombing London, because they were a bit reluctant. They're saying, well, actually, you know, we'd quite like to have an alliance with Britain, blah, blah. The other thing I was saying about Morton was that he was the aide-de-camp to General Haig in the First World War. So he was actually intimately involved in the mass slaughter, the horrendous, ridiculous trench warfare. Mm. And Haig, who was this figure apparently who never ever gave an opinion, he only ever gave orders. He'd say, right, bomb. And then no one could ever ask him, question him about anything. I mean, he's portrayed brilliantly in that Richard Attenborough film, Oh, What a Lovely War, from 1969, right from the middle of the sort of great season of brilliant films. And, you know, Haig was, Morton was working for him. Now, in Second World War, he was working for Churchill. But in between times, he did things like, for example, Morton was behind the Zinoviev letter, which was an attempt, well, it was a very successful attempt to scupper the Labour Party's chances of winning a general election between the wars. And it was a complete forgery made up by Morton. Morton also, incidentally, lived literally, and I've been down there in Kent near Crockham Hill and Chartwell, which is where Churchill lived, literally only about 30 or 40 minutes walk away from Winston Churchill. And they both bought houses down there. Early Lands in Crockham Hill was Morton's house, and Chartwell, just near Westerham, was Churchill's house at the same time. Actually, Morton moved in before Churchill did. So one wonders, Richie, who was really in charge?
Who was really in charge? Hidden History with Tony Gosling on the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford, 23 minutes past six, Europe's most listened to independent radio show. That sounds like an idle boast, D. It's not. You've got to sing when you're winning. I might have no listeners tomorrow, so we'll brag today. Tony is a proper journalist. With a terrific resume. Let's hope that he's back behind the microphone at BCFM real soon presenting the politics show, which is absolutely fantastic. Tony, would Israeli intelligence have known that these bastards, these murderous, mindless bastards, were being spirited out of Germany and sent to the United States? And if they did, why didn't they do anything about it at the time? I'm not trying to have a cheap shot at Israel. I do that most days. I have no time for Israel as a state. That's, of course, a very different thing. It's a hugely different thing when it comes to talking about Jews. Jews are Zionists. I have no problem with Jews. Zionists I don't see eye to eye with. They must have known it, Tony. What the bloody hell was going on with Israeli intelligence?
Well, great question. And of course, they did know. Just quickly, though, I will say we are doing the politics show online only. So if you go to thisweek.org.uk, you can find it there. It's definitely worth having. It's getting even more fiery now we've been taken off of FM. But anyway, look, back to the creation of the State of Israel and Israeli intelligence, because this was never a done deal. I mean, of course, you know that the Israeli state was formed basically by terrorists, people who were killing loads of Arabs, killing loads of Brits, and trying to create their own state. But it was by no means guaranteed that the UN was going to award them a state. They were umming and ahhing. They were saying, well, hang on, these guys are actually just a bunch of thugs and killers. We shouldn't reward them by giving them their own state, no matter if they're Zionists or not. But there was a whole kind of load of negotiations that went on before Israel finally became a state, was awarded such in 1947, on 29th of November. There was a vote at the United Nations, and that was delivered by Nelson Rockefeller, who delivered the crucial Latin American votes for the Zionists. After very, very heated negotiations with the people who were putting it all together, David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister, and Reuven Shiloh he was part of the, he was the intelligence chief really that set up the Mossad after Israel was created. And the UN just about recognized the state of Israel with a few votes that Nelson Rockefeller had pulled in from the Latin American countries where he had a lot of influence. So, but the thing is, what was the quid pro quo? What did they get in return? What did Nelson Rockefeller demand to deliver those votes? Well, he said, actually, Rockefeller says, you can have vengeance to Ben-Gurion, or you can have a country, but you can't have both. And that's an actual quote from John Loftus's book, Secret War Against the Jews. And I interviewed him, well, must be a year or so ago, maybe a bit less, about that. And he's been through the thing with John Loftus. He's a very interesting figure.
Lovely man, John. Really, lovely man. I interviewed John years ago. Lovely guy.
Because he was awarded this amazing status of FBI Special Investigator by Jimmy Carter to go through all the files. He had access to absolutely everything, including the nuclear files. And so he got to see just about everything in the US that had never been released. And Carter said to him, look, I want you to just, you know, no holds barred, warts and all, tell me what's in there. And so, you know, he's one of those people, I think, is just a one in a million, really, that's had access to this. So he makes it absolutely clear that the original founders of the Israeli state were told either you shut up about the Nazis, because, of course, the Americans had hundreds, if not thousands, of ex-Nazis working in their intelligence services already and their scientific services, and were intending to use all these people in the what eventually became the space program, etc. So they said, look, if you can get a country, but you better never speak about this again. And this is why when Adolf Eichmann was kidnapped and brought over to Israel, there was a big hoo-ha about this at the time. That is, it happened in May 1960. Eichmann, yeah. Basically, the agreement was broken. The Israelis said, no, we're going to have Eichmann. He was one of the main people behind the Final Solution. And at the time, there was a lot of suggestion as well, we've got Eichmann, what about Bormann? And of course, and that was 1960, but it was by 1972. They discovered who Bormann was, and I definitely recommend you, if you can share that photograph of Bormann taken by Ladislas Farago in 1972.
I will. You tweet it, and I'll retweet it. You've got thousands of Twitter followers as well. Let me just read you two quotes, two very quick quotes from Jim's book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, which I haven't read for years, but I have read it. In 1943, Bormann gained total control over both the Nazi Party and the German economy, including all top secret technology, incredibly. And Jim goes on to write, and Hitler said of Bormann, I know he is brutal, but what he undertakes, he finishes. I can absolutely rely on that. With his ruthlessness and brutality, he always sees out, he sees that my orders are carried out. Bormann reigned supreme.
Okay, I'll give you another quote.
Wow.
And this I was reading the other night about Bormann, is that Hitler, when people used to question saying, well, Bormann, you know, isn't he kind of a bit problematic? This is people like Goering, etc., who were having trouble. They didn't trust Bormann at all. Hitler would bang his fist on the same table and say, I need Bormann to win this war. He's the one that will deliver it, you know. So he was basically, Hitler had an immense amount of confidence in him. And that may be because Bormann knew a few secrets about Hitler's life before the war. And, you know, so in a way that Hitler was beholden to Bormann because he didn't want Bormann to leak any secrets of his pre-war life. For example, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there that he actually murdered his niece because his niece, he was having a relationship with her and she demanded to split up with Hitler. And then she was found dead. So, you know, and Bormann was one of the people who apparently had investigated that crime. So it looks to me as if, Bormann was a kind of mafia figure who just wanted to do whatever he wanted to do for himself. And he was an extremely selfish, pig-headed guy who just so happened to see the Second World War as a massive opportunity to do deals with some of the great powers in the world to make as much money as he possibly could, and prestige as well. I think to a certain extent, these people see themselves as really smart to be able to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. And my job and your job and any normal journalist's job should be to actually pull the wool up from people's eyes so we can see some of the hidden wiring behind these wars. And the interesting thing about Morton is he joins a lot of the dots of these two world wars together, having been the aide-de-camp for General Haig and then also a private secretary for Winston Churchill, no less, right the way from, you know, well before the war until the very end.
And you make a compelling case on the website, and you've been looking into it for years. You make a very compelling case by drawing together these historical events, mate. And because that's what you do, and saying, well, look at these events, look what happened here, knitting together these strands to make a very compelling case that Bormann was taken out of Germany.
The other thing is Ian Fleming's involvement. I mean, I think it's fascinating. Yeah. I was only just hearing Lucy Fleming, his niece, on the radio yesterday. But he, it seems, after the war, he was very depressed because he'd seen how things had gone. Suddenly, you know, he's been involved in this operation. Basically, they were conned. They were told, well, Bormann is going to we're going to get Bormann over here, and then all this money is going to be given back to the countries and the people that it was, that it was stolen from by the Nazis. And over the months and years after World War II, people like John Ainsworth Davis and Ian Fleming realised, well, actually, this has not happened. This money's just been disappeared. I mean, the money trail now looks as if it went mostly to South America, and also the money was laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell law firm in New York, which was the Dulles brothers law firm. Of course, those two were extremely powerful after World War II. One was Secretary of State, the other was the first head of the CIA, exactly. And those two people basically were in charge of the intelligence service post-war and the foreign policy. But there they were laundering all this money week after week after week using their New York law firm. I mean, there's a whole nother angle story to that. But, you know, I think if you go back to look at Morton particularly, you know, he's almost an unknown figure. During the war, he was a completely secret figure. He'd worked in intelligence between the wars. He'd also run something called the Political Intelligence Unit and Political Warfare Unit between the wars. These shadowy organizations that really aren't supposed to exist.
Yeah.
And he, to me, in some ways, comes out as the demon figure, the sort of Aleister Crowley figure in the background who sees the war as an opportunity to make a lot of money and also to basically line the pockets of the Fourth Reich Mafia once the war's finished.
I'm absolutely gobsmacked. I've been doing all the reading in the world, obviously, leading into this, you know, and shaking my head because I've learned so much in the last few days, even this afternoon, reading the website, reading your own website. It's incredible. I've put links on Twitter to where people can go and read this in black and white. Brilliant to have Tony talking about it. We're going to leave it for a minute, but Tony's not going anywhere. We've got about 15 minutes left in this programme. I wanted to bring us back to May 2020. And, the continuing pandemic saga. News today, we've heard Patrick Vallance on television today saying that the lockdown is not going to be ending anytime soon. The 2 meter distance between people has to continue. The Premier League's not going to start anytime soon. There will be football played for the next 12 months, by all accounts, behind closed doors. What I think, Tony, you talk about the Fourth Reich. Okay, we haven't been sent to concentration camps. We're not being worked to death or machine gunned to death and bulldozed into trenches. But this is a tyranny, I believe, that is being imposed on the people of this country and elsewhere around the world. How do you feel about it now?
Okay, look, I mean, I think you need. There's been lies, damn lies, and statistics, haven't there? I mean, for example, today we've had news that 32,000 people died of COVID-19 in Britain, and it's the highest death toll in Europe. Hang on, let's just roll back a minute. Those people didn't die of, they died with COVID-19. So this is one ingredient in their death, and you cannot equate the two. It's one or the other. Either they had no pre-existing symptoms or conditions, in which case they did die of COVID-19, or else it's been a contributor to their death. So I think if you're looking at the number of people who've died with pre-existing conditions, you're looking about, you know, let's call around about one third of the actual total have died. I mean, this is just a bit of a guess, really, but it certainly isn't the main total. If you're looking at the lethality of this disease from the best studied countries and regions, it's around about somewhere between, some scientists say 0.1% and 0.37%, which is around about the same range as a very severe or severe flu. We had 50,000 extra deaths in Britain between 2017 and the winter of 2017-2018, and now we've had something like 10,000 deaths from COVID-19 so far. There's the other side of all of this, which is that it looks to me, as we've just had more evidence of this yesterday from France, that this virus was actually quite widespread in Britain and in the US and France. We've heard from the Icelandics that their first cases in January had come from the Alps and come from the UK, not from China. So it looks to me as if Britain and the US and other countries were much further down the line with this virus before it was even recognised, Richie.
I had it, Tony. I'm sure I had it. I was in a very bad way in late January. It was so bad. I don't want to come across sounding like the scarecrow Boris Johnson, but I was in a bad place. I'm a very fit bloke. I've never in my life smoked, but I've had lung and chest problems intermittently over the years. And I was in a really bad state in late January. And they couldn't figure it out at the surgery. They said, we can see you're in great distress that you can't breathe easily, but there isn't any fluid or any mucus. And I could not get a breath. It was scary stuff to you. And they were giving me very strong steroids to take, and they weren't doing much good either. And I think it's only my experience of being, you know, asthmatic and having these problems over the years, when sometimes they got bad, and I've had double pneumonia, believe it or not, twice in my life. That's no joke either. I think that's what got me through. I managed to keep calm. The oft-mentioned other half, Caroline, was terrified. There were nights when it was dreadfully bad. I was off from the show for 3.5 weeks. I think I had it, T, whatever it is. I think I had it. And
I had something similar, didn't you? In the end of December too. I mean, I was in bed for 3.5 days, dosed up with paracetamol and aspirin, very high temperature. I didn't really know. When they first started talking about dry cough, I'd never had one really like that before, where you're coughing and coughing, but you're not really coughing anything up. You know, I had that for 2 weeks after every evening, you know, and it's just like, you know, please, can I go to sleep? I just keep coughing, you know. And so that was for 2 weeks afterwards. So I had, you know, basically 2.5 weeks of horrible stuff at the end of December. No idea, because, of course, it didn't exist then, did it?
No, it didn't exist then. And it makes sense now when you listen to Professor Hennigan, evidence-based medicine at Oxford. It makes more and more sense what he said, that whatever this is, once it was known, what should have happened was people that might be vulnerable to it, like me, even though I'm a young, healthy man, we should have started on the vitamin D and vitamin C, and we should have been careful indoors. But locking down 99% of everybody else who's healthy and who wouldn't even know they had it, or they might, like you, get that nasty cough and be unwell and physically sick for a couple of weeks. Locking everybody else down was crazy. And Tony, the damage, T, 3,000 Virgin Air, whatever it's called, employees gone. Right, you might, I don't mean you, but people might despise Branson. There's good reasons, fair enough. Tony, the damage that this is going to do, mate, to ordinary people in the next 12 months to 2 years. Most people, I don't think, have a clue just how bad this recession is going to be. What do you think?
Well, it's not just you and I. There's loads of people out there. When I first started talking about, once the symptoms were really talked about, in the mass media, and I said, well, hang on, I had this. There's now 7 or 8 people in Bristol I've spoken to who also had something. I mean, we're not talking about Facebook friends, people I know face to face. And also, interestingly, the BBC Natural History Unit had been filming abroad and came back, and there were 4 of them that went down with it on the 17th of December 2019. So, you know, this is one of the reasons I'm very, very suspicious about the way this is being dealt with, Richie. I just don't think that there's any kind of realistic understanding that actually it's potentially originated somewhere completely different from China, and that it's just that when it reached China, when it reached Wuhan particularly, That's when all the media and all the pandemonium and the hysteria started. Look, the other thing is, how lethal is this compared to normal flu? Well, it is quite, it's a bit more lethal than normal flu, particularly because it's passed around so easily. It's definitely a novel coronavirus, but coronavirus is something which carries the common cold. There is this thing called the pandemic scale, which is rather like the Beaufort scale is, you know, for wind, like gale force, hurricane force, and all yeah. that. But actually, it's this only comes out at category 2 on there. Which is, it goes up to category 5. So this is, you know, this is a very mild pandemic according to that scale, where they say only voluntary isolation of particularly sick people is envisaged as the main measure when that scale was invented. If you were to take the current pandemic's, you know, death rates and look at that. So very, very peculiar and particularly weird is this whole idea in Britain that we're going to be saved by this app and by mandatory vaccination. The app, for example, you know, how many really elderly people do you know with a smartphone? It just doesn't make sense. They haven't thought this through at all. But I think that they're all pinning all their hopes on Bill Gates and his wonderful vaccine. And we all know, well, most of us know, although the mass media haven't told us, about Bill Gates and his incredible successes with vaccines killing and sterilizing people around the world.
I wonder, I like your more kind of a broad look at things without jumping in with 2 feet. I've always enjoyed that about you. You look at any theory. What about the theory that, you know, people have used this phrase they've coined, plandemic? Namely, that it is some sort of bioweapon and its purpose is to convince people that the world must change and that from now on in, we must get used to being vaccinated for things to enable us to go about our daily business. I'm beginning to think that's a very plausible theory. Of course, I can't prove it, but it makes sense to me. Go ahead.
Okay, well, one of the things I came across when I was over in New Zealand was the fact that over there, there were quite a lot of health professionals, doctors, nurses, etc., working in care homes, etc., that didn't want to have the flu vaccine. Obviously, if they caught flu, they'd stay away from work, etc., but they didn't actually believe the vaccine was the right thing to do, that it was worse for their health.
Yeah.
And so it was only quite a low take-up amongst people that know about health of the flu vaccine in New Zealand. So what they did is they said anyone who comes into work who hasn't had the flu vaccine, doctors, nurses, or any staff, has to wear a face mask. And do you know how long it took them to have the vaccine, Richie?
Go on.
2 or 3 months. And almost every healthcare worker in New Zealand had had the flu vaccine because they didn't want to have to wear a face mask every day at work. So this is how they're doing it, by various forms of coercion. And I just think we need to kind of resist the silly idea, for example, that everybody has got to walk around with a face mask on. That isn't going to make any difference whatsoever if you've already had the illness, has it, for example? And what we're saying now is that, oh, well, we're not testing anybody, so you're never going to be able to know whether you had it. So you're just on the precautionary principle. You've got to have the mandatory vaccine. You've got to have the ID 2020, the digital ID. Yeah. You've got to walk around with a face mask, blah, blah. So basically, we're moving over to the presumption of guilt, basically. And also away from the most important principle in medicine, which is called informed consent. You decide what happens to your body.
Your body.
I can see a mass resistance to this starting up against the idea of an ID that you have to use to access public transport, etc., where you've got to show you've been vaccinated, because I think the Brits are a truculent lot. And they're not just going to go and have a vaccine because they're told to, although the Germans might. In fact, there's a lot of, Matt Hancock back in September was talking about, oh, we must have mandatory vaccination in Britain.
That's right, he was,
and he was talking at the time about doing it to children. And now we know that the COVID-19 hardly affects kids at all. So what are you going to do? Ah, right, he's changed his mind last night. Oh, well, children is not really important. We're going to have to make sure it's all the old people that get it. Well, there's a lot of old people that don't want to do this, and I don't think he's going to get anywhere if he tries to go down this mandatory vaccination route. And all he's going to do with this app, I think, contact tracing, is alienate even more people because they don't trust this app, and hardly anyone's going to download it. There's a tremendous amount of evidence that they're just trying to follow the Bill Gates agenda here. And of course, you know, the funding by Bill Gates of Imperial College's survey, which was the thing that tipped Boris Johnson, saying, no, we're not going to go for herd immunity in Britain. We're going to go for, you know, we're going to go for lockdown, an infinite lockdown. They've got no exit strategy, Richie. No exit strategy.
None whatsoever. Let me put a counter argument. Let's make this final question for today. Let me put a counter argument to your characterization of the Brits as truculent. Here's the counter argument. In fact, it's Hayden Hewitt's argument. That's LiveLeak.com's Hayden Hewitt, TriggerWarning.tv. Hayden made a good point in a conversation with me on the Dog and Bone yesterday. He said, Richie, I know your audience, he said, will be, I'm not having that. They'll bring in this vaccine. I'm not having it. But he said, Richie, look, you'll have relatives down the country, senior relatives. You'll have relatives overseas. You'll have your lifestyle. You'll have your, you know, I like to go to the theatre, I like to go to the cinema. You'll have all of this. He mentioned the coercion that you mentioned earlier, great word. And he said, don't be surprised if people whom you wouldn't have imagined would have acquiesced and taken up the offer of the vaccine will do it because of that. And I got to thinking of, again, the oft-mentioned future Mrs. Allen, wonderful woman with beautiful family members in Nancy, in the northeast of France. You know, a young but you know, maturing mother, a grandmother who's 98, whom she loves. She has the same feelings as I do about vaccines. But I think maybe in 6 or 8 months' time, she might find herself having no choice, T.
Okay. So you can, if it's, I mean, surely, if you have the vaccine, that doesn't make you any less likely that you're going to be immune to this if,
of course,
you believe what we're being told about reinfection, which personally I don't believe. I mean, what we've seen from Iceland and from Sweden is they're saying, well, no, people are not getting in any kind of reinfection. But at the end of the day, we, you know, there's been a horrendous amount of hysteria around this, and lots of elderly people are extremely frightened. They think that this is far, far worse than flu. They're being convinced that it's an absolute horrible killer disease. It is a little bit worse than a bad flu, but not a lot worse. And actually, many of those people have got other conditions who are being told about. You notice on the news, for example, the only people they're really reporting on, generally speaking, are middle-aged and young people. So when one of those dies, it gets a massive amplification. This is extremely frightening. This is what is one of the reasons why I think the media, once again, just like 9/11, is absolutely culpable on scaring many, many people into thinking, God, we've got to do something, you know, peculiar and particularly special about this virus. Actually, really what we need to do is follow, I think, is Sweden's lead, even though not following them down the road of digital IDs and implanting
cashless society as well, Do you know,
cashless society.
Do you know, Tony?
But we need to be following that basic idea that we need to just make sure the young people have got herd immunity. Let me just tell you one little thing. When I was over in New Zealand, they say, oh, this immunity doesn't last, right? They're talking about that time and time again, even with flu. When there was the original pandemic, the Spanish flu back in 1918, the indigenous people in the Maoris over in New Zealand had 7 times more casualties. People died in their population than in the white population. Why? Because even though they didn't necessarily had a bad flu, a lot of the white people had it in their bloodstream from their parents even. So it has an incredible amount of efficacy. In the past, if one of your ancestors has had one of these nasty viruses, it might well help you survive. It didn't help the Maoris, but you know, this is the opposite of what we're being told. So I'm convinced a lot of that is just strategic lying, Richie.
I think you're right. And as usual, I don't keep as calm as you and as, you know, as circumspect. I see it being just evil beyond belief. There's an agenda, I believe, to change human experience as we know it. I do believe in a transhumanist agenda. I've spoken to some very, very good people about that over the years, including scientists from, you know, some very respected universities in the United States. it's terrible. This we see the patented stuff. It's all there if people want to see it. The MIT papers written for Bill Gates and his cohorts. This digital, vaccine that leaves the tattoo that can be read digitally by the smartphones. It's sickening stuff, Tony. It really is. And I think coercion is the buzzword today. A lot of our listeners are in agreement with you, and they don't like to be in agreement with Hayden. They love Hayden, but they don't like agreeing with him because he doesn't share a lot of their opinions. But
the Gates Foundation, I think, is a perfect example of the sort of thing that should be smashed into little pieces. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's exactly analogous, really. I mean, I think it was David Livingstone, the guy who's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which all of your listeners should get and read.
Many of them have.
It's really interesting. It's basically the new fascism. This is what we're dealing with, these people. And the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, what David Livingstone said is Bill Gates is the new Rockefeller, because Rockefeller monopolized, using all sorts of dark tactics, dirty tricks, the oil industry in America by what they call vertical integration, where he just controlled everything, the petrol stations, oil fields, refineries, and he used all sorts of dirty tricks to control the whole market in the US during the time of the First World War. And that there was an attempt to break up the Rockefeller Standard Oil Empire. But that was a failure, really, because he kept all the shares. He just ran various different companies.
He certainly did.
ExxonMobil and the rest. But what Gates has done is he's done exactly the same sort of thing using Windows and Microsoft, you know, and which controls Skype, which we're talking on now.
That's
you
right.
know, they are everywhere, Richie. They are everywhere. And these monopolists take their profits and they pay no tax whatsoever. And instead, they use it through these so-called wonderful foundations like the Gates Foundation to get Imperial College and the Johns Hopkins University to tell our government, give our government presentations on what they have to do when COVID-19 comes along. And all they're really after is to get their vaccines out there. And, of course, they get absolutely millions and millions and millions. They make a fantastic amount of money out of these. But not only that, they get power. They get the power to stick into you whatever they want.
The politics show will be on air this week. It's online at the moment, as BCFM, like everybody else, is on hiatus because of the lockdown. Thisweek.org.uk is where you'll find out about the politics show. I doubt you haven't heard. I'm sure you've heard of it. But if you're new to Tony, if you've just tuned into this program, you've not heard Tony before, check him out. It's terrific. It's online this week, and hopefully you'll be back on the studio. You'll be in the studio again real soon, because your program is vital. I enjoy listening to it, and I do steal from it. I nick from it from time to time, but I always give you credit, as is the case.
Yeah, that's the idea. People can steal anything.
Give you credit, though.
Okay. I mean, we did a review of the Planet of the Humans film as well this week, which is just out by Michael Moore's latest film, which has caused immense ructions in the green community. All these green people.
It has, hasn't it?
Greenies that thought that they were supporting something good have suddenly found out, actually, the people that we've been supporting all these years, oh, my God, they're building wood-fired power stations. Right. Oh, my God, and they're cutting down all the forest and the rainforest to fire. And we've been supporting them. But you know what, Richie? Very few of them want to actually admit that what they've done has been suckered. And so, of course, they go, oh, this is a terrible film. It's a very dangerous film. You see that all over the place. But actually, it's a brilliant film. It's well worth watching.
Fairly
low budget, but it's absolute mind blower. And I think it's one of those things that will really make you think about, it's incredible the extent to which people can be hoodwinked.
Do you know why they can't take a step back, people? Because the biggest plague afflicting humanity at the moment isn't the coronavirus. It's identity politics. That's what it is, in my opinion. I've been reading and even writing on my own website over the last few years about identity politics. Look, we could talk about that all day long, and we will do another day. The Borman report was absolutely fascinating, Tony. Well put together, mate. A lot of food for thought there. It's you said to me, oh, jump in and put it to me. And I thought, no, I won't, because it's theory, but it's theory backed up by wonderful circumstantial evidence. It's a great report. I really appreciate it.
What makes really good radio is what you've prompted today, which is me putting two and two together live as we're chatting about the two main occasions where this whole idea of Borman's body being discovered in Berlin was Firstly, when Stuart Stephen and Ladislas Farago had this Daily Express front page headline, Martin Bormann alive, literally within the next week or so, they suddenly discovered his body.
That's
in Berlin.
Right.
Isn't that amazing coincidence? And the second one, the second time being upon the publication of the absolutely mind-blowing and brilliant, once you've started it, I guarantee you won't stop reading. It's called OpJB, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War. I'm just going to flick to the front cover to see. It's 1996 that was published, and it was literally again a couple of weeks after that was published that we got another load of stuff saying, oh, Bormann's skull has been discovered, blah blah blah. And the other thing to mention is that this marked the beginning of a load of sort of counter wave of books coming out saying, oh, Adolf Hitler has survived, Grey Wolf, and the rest of them.
Did you? Yeah.
Actually, they were, I believe, they were simply another strategic lie operation in order to divert attention from the fact it was Bormann that survived. Basically, Hitler had run out of steam by the end of the war. You know, he had nothing left. He was on drugs and things to try and keep him going. And he actually wanted to die. It's just some kind of like sacrificial death. That's the way he saw himself. Bormann, by the way, was the one who was entrusted with his will and brought it to London.
That's,
and that's
right.
The details about that as well.
Misinformation, you know, put out there about Hitler to obscure the truth about Bormann. Mate, I could talk to you all night long. You know that's true. I mean that. We're just about out of time. By the way, Tony is on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. There's only one, at Tony Gosling. Thisweek.org.uk. And I've tweeted a link to the Bormann report, politicsthisweek.wordpress.com. It's Martin Bormann and the Nazi Gold. A tonic, mate. I had a great tonic last night with Mark Bajerski. I've had another one tonight with you. Thanks for coming on. And I know you'll be back on again real soon, Tony. Thank you.
We certainly will, Richie. God bless. Thanks very much.
You too, buddy. Thanks for that. Again, folks, the Politics Show will be online this week, thisweek.org.uk, not from the studio, but they're doing it online. You've just been listening to my pal, the great Tony Gosling, live from Bristol. That's about it then, really, for the programme. Thanks for listening to us. Thanks for all your tweets. There's a great conversation going on there on Twitter, not only about Bormann, but about the circumstances surrounding other prominent Nazis and how they got into Europe and into the UK and, of course, into the United States. Really enjoyed that conversation. I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow night on the programme. I do have a guest. I'm sure I do. And I do have a guest on Thursday. In fact, I must drop her a line and make sure that she's still on for Thursday. There was something else to tell you briefly, but it's gone out of my head now, so it can't be too important anyway. Yes. No, yes. Yes, I wanted to thank those of you who put your hands into your pockets after Mark Bajerski said some very nice things about the radio programme last night and about the funding of it. Some of you made contributions to the programme for the first time ever, and I want to thank you for doing that from the bottom of my heart. It means a lot to me. I very rarely mention it. I just don't like mentioning it. But it's important, you know, I work 6 days a week full time. It's about 80 hours a week. That's not a lie, really. It's incredible. About 80 hours a week putting this together. And, well, I'm going to be honest, a little bit less with this coronavirus madness. But there's an enormous amount of work goes into it. I edit, I produce, and I introduce the Richie Allen radio show. And then afterwards, I archive it and get it online. It's a pretty enormous workload. But I love it. I love doing it. And the only income the programme has is your support. I will never use the term donate again. Nobody donates to me. It's not a charity. You support it. And because you do, I'll be grateful for the rest of my life. Thanks again to Mark Bajerski. Going out with Patti Smith and Because the Night, written by Bruce Springsteen, of course. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. Thanks to Jean Ann for a brilliant bit of production tonight with the Jim Mars book. Thanks, Jean Ann. Bye now.